So the other thing I will mention is these videos that Risa showed you guys. They made lots of videos like that in Michigan. Their incidents have gone up a lot after I left. So I feel like, if anything, I was not debauchery. I was the opposite of. I was like keeping you guys from embracing your inner video selves. I'm hoping there'll be something. I'm hoping that'll be up on YouTube. So, because you know, it's gonna probably compete. It is great. It's gonna compete with that Fox video probably. I don't know. We'll see about that. Anyhow, so this talk is a little bit different than what I listed. But basically, you know, you've heard this buzzword of big data. So this is less about my research, but more about where I think the field's headed, and what I think is sort of important for professors to be involved with. And what I want to talk about today is actually something that we don't think about that much, which is the issue of measurement. So as statisticians, typically, we get our data set, we get the matrix or whatever, but thinking about what exactly the matrix represents and thinking critically about that, I think is an important point. I think it's probably, and again, given we're measuring more things, I think it's probably important to rethink that and just reinvigorate that. So just, this shows you that I'm not very good with PowerPoint. Basically, I have no relationship to disclose other than obviously my dad's in the audience. People at Michigan make funny videos about me. So I'm going to start this with a talk with an anecdote. So this is at Penn State a couple years ago. There was a student graduating who had worked on doing a lot of genomic data analyses, and a lot of what I do at Penn State now is looking at genetic or genomic data. So he mentioned a comment by his advisor, who's very big in this field in biology, and basically the comment was they've been analyzing GWAS data all wrong. And so GWAS means genome-wide association studies. It's probably something many of you are familiar with, and in fact, if you read Ann Lehrer's talk, she alluded to it as well, is this idea of looking at DNA variations and their associations with the phenotype. So when someone says they've been analyzing GWAS data all wrong, it's a pretty provocative comment, right? So I wasn't exactly sure what the student meant. So, trying to be a good consulting statistician, sort of tried to get him to clarify what he meant. So really what the advisor and student thought was they've been analyzing GWAS data all wrong because they had been using something called SNP microarrays, which is one type of technology, all called technology number one, and not sequencing technology. And again, this comment, again, is a few years old. And in fact, this field of physical genetics has moved from microarray-based platforms to sequencing platforms. So that did happen. But what I realized is when they said analysis, they really didn't mean analysis. What they meant was that the instrument for how you measure these variations was the wrong instrument to be using. So that's really a measurement issue. And I think an issue or a problem is a lot of times in public health and in medical settings, people will take analysis and measurement and actually conflate them, meaning they can't separate one from the other properly. And they really mean measurement when they say analysis, they mean measurement. So again, thinking about big data, I mean, it's sort of, I think, relevant to big data because basically what big data is saying is we're measuring more and more things on people. So here's a variety of examples. Some I've been involved with, but I'm sure many you've been involved with as well, that are sort of very cool or emerging. Genomics is one I've looked at a lot over the last decade. There are people, and in fact, I guess we've seen talks today as well by the other speakers on doing things like looking at data spatially or from a small area perspective. Imaging technologies is another kind of area where there's a lot of sort of emphasis on measuring and creating large data sets of looking at brain activity patterns. Something more sort of in the behavioral world is something called ecological momentary assessment data, which is also another example of measurement. And then sort of the one that's very in vogue these days is network data. And so I'm using network very loosely. So network could mean you're studying infectious disease and you want to see how the disease transmits across individuals. So your disease transmission is a network. I could be talking about you're really bored with my talk and you want to surf the web, so you go to Facebook and you have friends on Facebook and your friends and their friends make up a network of relationships. So again, I'm sort of using, or you could be just where you click on the web, which would be a network. So these are different and emerging data types that we're all having to deal with as statisticians. In terms of thinking about big data issues, what I think about a lot, if you have lots of things you're looking at, there's an inherent multiplicity problem. And again, Nan made a great discussion of that in her talk earlier today. Another issue, and the second two relate to what she was talking about, which is meta-analysis. You're thinking about combining the data. How do you sort of quantify whether a study is reproducible or not over multiple studies, as well as trying to combine them? So these are things I think about as a statistician. But what I want to talk about today really is, are we measuring what we really think we want to be measuring? So the really question is, if this is a question, then what is the role of theory or science in the data process? And basically what I'll sort of say is we are in the age now where we're measuring more and more things on phenomena of which we really know less. So that's sort of, you know, the big buzz phrase here. So think about measurement. Again, the way I mentioned it earlier, basically I think of, as statisticians, we think of getting the data from the collaborator or designing a study to collect the data. And again, typically we don't think about it. We think that the investigator collaborator has to, do that for us. There is some work in this area, and I would say the leading statistician that's written about this is a professor in England called David Hand, who's at Imperial College in London, and he has a book, 2004, on this idea. And there's actually a recent paper by Stephen Sen in Stanson Med on this issue in clinical trials. But again, what I'll be talking about today isn't necessarily clinical trials. It could be observational studies as well. And I'll have two examples that are more observational in nature. And again, think about measurement. The investigator is looking at a system of subjects. And I'm using these terms very vaguely because it really depends on the context. So this could be a biomedical study where you have individuals you're following over time. And you have properties of interest on that system that you want to measure. So this idea of measurement theory, what it basically says is you have this thing about a system you want to study or you want to make inference about, but you want to be able to assign a number to that property. So how do you do that? So basically you assign a number about the property of the system for your subject, and then you try to understand what that assignment means across all subjects. And again, another part is to think about whether different attributes or different numbers can be combined in a sensible way. So I'm being very abstract here, but just to give you sort of a historical background here, this idea of measurement theory comes from physics in the early 20th century. So in physics, they're obviously thinking about physical objects. Physical objects have a height, they have a weight, they have a mass. So they're thinking about measurement, and basically the height, the weight, and the mass of something in physics is an inherent property of that system. So there, that's not how you assign a number to the mass. You know, you take its weight and you give it assign mass in kilograms or pounds. So it led to a very coherent system for measurement. So it doesn't really work as well in public health. And in public health, I'm thinking very much in the behavioral science, social science types of settings, because in fact these properties are not easy to define. And the example I'll give, and again, I think someone alluded to it in a previous talk, is the thing about mental health. How do you characterize a mental state, right? We have lots of surveys. We have lots of instruments that are available for when you ask questions, and the answers sort of define that state. But the key point here is that doing that leads to what Hand calls operational measurement theory, where basically the thing you use to measure, your survey, your instrument, it actually defines a property. So basically, really the point of the talk today is a lot of times we should be making inference about the measurement process. But what we end up doing is we try to generalize that to something more abstract that we might not be able to do that. So I'll give two examples because right now I know I'm being very abstract with the way I'm describing it. You have an instrument, you ask questions, you find some associations, but then you want to be able to, then people try to say something more broadly about mental health or whatnot. But the key thing here is that the measurement process itself defines the property of interest. So this is very different from physics, what they looked at the beginning with measurement theory, because there aren't any inherent properties of the system. So the basic point here as well is that we have a property defined by the measurement process. There actually should be, based on the answer we get, we should then look back and see whether or not the measurement process is doing a good job. And if it isn't, then we should try to refine the measurement process. So that's the part that I think we don't do enough of. we sort of take the data as is and try and analyze it and fit our complicated, sophisticated model to that. But if we think really about the data and do the data and the measurements really reflect the underlying phenomenon we care about, whether we're doing that enough or not. And again, this interpretation here should really be on the property defined by the measurement, and Hand refers to this as a construct. And basically, the point here is if we want to say something about the more abstract, amorphous thing, that really we should never take any results from this type of a setup as hypothesis confirming, but really hypothesis generating. Because really what we always need in the end are better ways of measuring the things we care about. And this idea was actually echoed by Otis Duncan, who's a famous sociologist, in his 1966 American Journal of Sociology paper, where he talked about using path models, or path analysis models in sociology. So let me give some examples. So here is sort of the thing I talk about, and again, a lot of this comes through interacting with collaborators, mostly at Penn State. This is an example of a latent model for correlating depression, immune function, and illness. And this is basically using what's known as a framework called structural equations modeling. And in particular, I think there's a software package called Lizrel, which sort of has pictures like this. So the way to interpret this picture, if you are a statistician, is that basically the rectangles are the things that you actually observe or measure on the person. And the circles represent the random variables here. So basically, deep 1, deep 2, deep 3 are three measures of depression, and they could be questions that you've asked on a survey to the subject. And then basically you see that it's connected to a circle saying depression. So the circle depression is basically the latent construct based on the observed deep 1, deep 2, deep 3. Same with the other, so M1, M2, M3 are the observed measures of immune function, and again, those can be measured through some monitor, some assay, and again, they are reflective of immune function in the circle. And similarly, illness 1, 2, 3 are the observed illness in the circle is the latent. So basically, circles are latent, and rectangles are observed. So basically, if you work with various types of investigators in the behavioral sciences, in epidemiology, and in social sciences, they love these kinds of models, right? They love these kinds of models. So one claim they will make is that, you know, this is a causal model. The reason it's a causal model is because notice I have circles, and I have an arrow going from depression to immune function, and an arrow going from immune function to illness. So in some sense, we're saying that depression causes immune function, and immune function causes illness. Notice also in this example, I actually also have arrows going from the circles to each other. So there's a possibility of like a feedback. So again, the arrows basically are encoding concepts that sort of seem very scientifically pleasing. The idea of causality, the idea of feedback. But again, as a statistician, I think what we're working with is this row, right? Everything on this row. I mean, that's what we get. And so I really always worry about overinterpreting inferences about circles based on what you observe in the rectangles, or trying to say too much. So again, what Hand would basically say about this picture is, I'm using deep 1, deep 2, deep 3 to come up with the construct of depression. I'm using M1, M2, M3 to come up with a construct for immune function. And I'm using illness 1, illness 2, illness 3 to come up with a construct for illness. I could do it separately for each set of variables by themselves, or I try to do it in a joint way. But I think what Hand would say was basically, the inferences I'm making about would really be about the association between constructs. And you would not try to say something more ambitious like depression causes immune function, which causes illness. So again, it's really, again, and this is something that we sort of think about as a lot when we're collaborating with people about not to overinterpret data. And this is just sort of trying to, sort of a reminder of that, sort of rooted in this measurement idea. So here's another example. So this is from neuroimaging, which is an area I've sort of recently been working on at Penn State. So this is talking about an instrument called fMRI, which is functional magnetic resonance imaging. So the basic idea is you put patients in a scanner, and then you measure changes in their blood flow. And basically one phenomenon that's used to generate fMRI data, which is a matrix that we get, is what's called the Bold contrast. which is, and the BOL stands for blood oxygen level dependent contrast. So the idea here is that you're basically going to have some sort of what's called a hemodynamic response in the blood flow. But again, what people do is they take this hemodynamic response in the blood flow to mean, oh, your brain's active, right? So then you get, in brain imaging, you get pictures of different parts of the brain that light up or light down based on this measurement, and they take that to mean is the brain active in that region or not. So that's, and again, fMRI I would say is a very very commonplace technology in brain imaging, and now what's happening as well is we're going from outside the scientific experimentation or university setup to actual using it in legal settings. So basically now we have fMRIs being used in court. The idea here now is that if a defendant is on trial and they basically have some sort of abnormal brain activity pattern, provided they can have some sort of a biological association with, like, for example, a DNA variation and that pattern, they can potentially, lawyers have this now argument to say that, oh, look, his behavior was actually partly attributable by the association of the DNA variant or the gene with the brain activity pattern. So basically, there have been a few examples where this argument has been used in court as a way of trying to exonerate defendants. So this is becoming quite real, right? So now we're going from the sort of the academic setting of using brain imaging to trying to use it as a way of deciding something in court, and basically whether that person's guilty. So I would say we've actually raised the stakes up a lot by doing this. So the corollary here is, if we really want to do this, are we sure that this thing that's shown here, which is an fMRI image, is really measuring brain activity? Because that's basically the argument that the lawyer is making here. Okay, so this is a publication from Nature from a few years ago. And basically the idea here is trying to figure out, is fMRI really measuring the brain activity pattern? So this is actually a very controlled setup. This was, I should say, this is also looking at mice. So here they developed a new system where basically the fMRI is the blue line, and then the new system was the green line. And basically, they also had, this was I said this was in mice, so basically they could stimulate the mice. And what you see up here are, you have peaks drop off. So basically they have this periodic stimuli that they're giving to the mice. And the key thing to know here is actually what's going on here. Basically the blue one, which is the fMRI, and the green one, which is their measurement, which was sort of closer to the brain activity and sort of mimics the stimulus pattern, you see down here that the correlation is actually really poor, 0.03. So basically, the argument that they made was that, in fact, the bold contrast hemodynamic response might not be the best measure of brain activity. So again, I think people who work in brain imaging would say that that's sort of a well-known fact, but I still want to remind you that if really your ultimate goal in sort of a public health or legal setting is to be able to use this kind of an instrument to make this kind of a decision, I would argue you'd have to have a pretty good sense that your instrument is actually measuring what you think it should be measuring. Yeah, so anyhow, the finding of this, the implication of that picture I showed you was that fMRI might not be as great a measure of brain activity as peasant previously thought. And again, so this is what I think is what should be the main result, is to think about, are there other ways we can be measuring brain activity that are not fMRI? And in particular, fMRI relies on this BOL phenomenon. Maybe there are other ways of doing this that don't rely on that. Because basically what the Surat and Das paper says, that BOL isn't necessarily a good predictor of brain activity. And so that's where it's starting to happen. Here's a second example, which is a field I'm more familiar with, which is genomics. So this is something called gene regulation. So basically, in basic biology, there's a molecule called a transcription factor, and it sort of controls when it binding to the genome stimulates regulation or expression. And basically, So basically, there's been a technology developed recently that sort of gets at ChIP-seq. It's called ChIP-seq, and it's the technology for finding these locations throughout the genome. And again, to give you basic biology for this talk, where a transcription factor binds, it turns on nearby genes, so they become transcribed. So understanding the behavior of transcription factors is important. And what I will say is that when people look try to do this, really the algorithms that are being developed are actually trying to find locations on the genome that have higher enrichment of a transcription factor. Okay, so here's a picture from a recent paper. So this is three experiments, and it's the same cell population. And basically, you see CHIP, EXO, ChIP-seq, ChIP-chip. These are three different technologies, basically. But since it's the same cell population, we'd expect sort of where they bind to be sort of the same place. So basically, the point of this paper is that ChIP-EXO, which is their method, you basically see the peak is a lot more narrow than the other two peaks. So basically, they argue that this is being one of the reasons why their technology was better. So it's good in that it's minimizing variation, which we like. But what I will say is, in this field, people want to talk about functions of transcription factors, and basically all they have for function is this: where does it bind on the genome? So that leap I'm talking about, of going from the thing that's observed to something more latent or ambiguous, is happening here. So I would still make the case that you can't necessarily conclude the function just based on this assay. But again, in this field, that's exactly sort of what's going on. So again, this sort of speaks to thinking about other ways we can sort of, if you want to think about the function of a transcription factor, are there other assays we should be doing or thinking about trying to integrate into this analysis? Okay, so in terms of theory, basically, this is what I'll say: we will have bigger data sets. We already have big data sets, but okay. We'll have bigger data sets. So one consequence is basically, Otis Duncan points to in his 1966 paper, almost 50 years ago as well, is you're basically going to be drifting through a sea of correlations and associations, right? And basically, I'm sure many of you who work with collaborators probably have this issue now already. If you look at multiple models, multiple variables, multiple phenotypes, whatever, you probably have this. And again, basically what I want to bring you back to is we're going to have these things. People talk a lot about doing agnostic assessments or de novo or sort of unbiased by not trying to incorporate theory. I actually would make the other claim, which is I think we're going to need theory even more, because what theory will give us is testable predictions. And basically, you can imagine, and the more well-formulated theory is, the more focused predictions it can make. And if you can make those predictions, you can actually then use the data to test those predictions. If those predictions don't come up, then that sort of says your theory is wrong, and you have to go back and refine the theory. And this idea of doing analysis, if it's wrong going or not working, going back and finding theory, is, I think, a place where statisticians sort of need to play a bigger role in this iterative process. So here's one. I mean, I would say in many disciplines, including many that they're talking about here, what investigators ultimately want to understand is causality. Does something cause, does X cause Y, right? And again, statistics, I would say, sort of the major framework that has been adopted for this idea is what's called potential outcomes. And I think, again, this is, potential outcomes to me is a theory. And it's a theory that, will make predictions that we can then use our big data to try and validate or invalidate. And if it's not consistent with the data, then you go back and refine the theory. So again, future of statistics. I guess I'm going back to being vague here, but basically I imagine sort of when we're thinking about some phenomena of interest, we're going to have multiple types of data. But again, I talked about this problem of the thing we care about not necessarily being direct, not being a great link to the observed data. So I'm calling that indirect evidence. So I had no idea what Nandler was going to talk about today. So the fact that he was talking about meta-analysis, so this is... I was pleased to hear that. And basically thinking about approaches like what she talked about, with the caveat that there will be substantial heterogeneity, which she also talked about across the objects or subjects. So I think that's a sort of something that'll keep us in business for a very long time. So, but in terms of statistics, thinking about statistical science,
One thing that sort of really pleased me about the talks I heard today in this session was that everyone sort of presenting their talk seemed to be very well grounded in the context, and thinking about the process of the data as well as the context in which you're studying the problem. And basically sort of having that knowledge, which is really domain knowledge, is what you need to be able to help the investigator sort of go back if you wanted to attempt to make the measurement process be better or improve it. You need that kind of knowledge. So again, you know, the having sort of domain knowledge is important, I think, here, which is why I'm not calling it the statistical science, because that involves a conversation and involvement with the investigator. And again, just sort of the caveats that we've had many times in the past, where be aware of limitations in our measurements and the levels which we can generalize, which is that whole measurement theory thing I talked about earlier. And then really, I think, being clear about exploratory versus confirmatory. And again, if you really want to be conservative, probably what we should be doing is saying that every analysis we report is exploratory at best, right? I think there are very few settings short of a regulated setting a la the FDA where we actually have confirmatory hypotheses that we get tested. So I think I told you earlier I'm not very good at PowerPoint. This really shows that. My poor lack of drawing arrows, but now I have I use boxes because it should all be observed, not latent, not circles. So basically, the process I sort of imagine, and again, what I think is you have a theory that explains a phenomenon. You develop a measurement technology to study that phenomenon. And then, again, what we do a lot is right here, right? We generate, we help with generation, analyze, interpret the data. So basically, the arrows are supposed to denote where I think statisticians should be playing a big role. So what I alluded to today was basically people developing alternative measurement technologies. But if you have domain knowledge, you can also help with this one. So basically what I encourage statisticians to do is to sort of get on both arrows, basically. So to conclude, so the acknowledgement here is actually the collaborators that I've had in Michigan and Penn State that work in biology. I'm saying biology broadly because some of it's genetics, some of it's the brain imaging field. Tom Nichols, who was a former colleague of mine at Michigan, now at University of Warwick, who, I mean, based on everything I know about brain imaging, I learned from him. Also just Bruce and Jeffrey for organizing this session and just giving me the opportunity to talk, and just the outstanding colleagues that I've had both at Michigan and biostatistics, a lot of whom you saw in the video, as well as Penn State statistics, and last and definitely not least, my family, by which I mean both immediate family as well as my wife and my kids. So thank you.